Yeah, I've never replaced an MP before. That's quite fun. Maybe that suits me. Please no. So, yes, last minute replacement, but hopefully be able to give you a bit of an overview of some of the work that the Science, Innovation and Technology Committee have put together, but also some of the work that's been going on in the sector within this space already. So as mentioned, I'm the lead for EDIS. EDIS is a coalition of 29 organisations across the life science and health research sector who've come together with shared commitments around EDI, primarily that it's important, secondary that, you know, senior leadership need to be brought into it, and thirdly, that collaboration is really key to progress in this area. There's no point working with sort of random pockets of activity without working together towards shared goals, because often you find that those organisations, those activities, end up butting up against each other, and you end up creating new frictions where someone's trying to start some sort of innovative idea, but actually it just fundamentally doesn't work in the rest of the system. So we're really trying to build that sort of co-creation, co-learning space, and at the same time, listening to what the members and what the sector needs to develop the kind of communal resources that fill those gaps. So where we find that, you know, 29 organizations are all saying to us, how do we collect diversity data? Trying to fill that gap a little bit for them as well. So we've got the DAISY guidance that we published a few years ago and regularly update as well. In terms of kind of what I was supposed to talk about today, not long before I came on stage, I was told to be provocative. And I'm glad that I got that post having written provocative things down. But I think it's super important to note that this work is obviously not new. This work has been going on for many, many years, many decades. I may look baby-faced, I'm older than I am, but even then, I'm still a newcomer on the scene in the sort of long scholarship and activism that's been working in this area. And I just think it's really important to recognize that some of those activities that have been going on for decades, particularly if we think about things like women in STEM and Black women in STEM, there's decades of reports that go back to the sort of 60s and 70s, even within the US, within the UK and globally, that really are providing recommendations that we would have expected to see taken up by the Science Technology Committee today. And we would have expected the government to have responded saying that they would do those as well, because actually the problems fundamentally are still there and they are still the same. I think it's really important to note that the closest the government's response got to the committee inquiry today, committee inquiry report, was talking about entrenched imbalances, which is really pale language, really sort of damp squib language. You know, it's just not talking about the fundamental problem, which is social injustice and societal inequalities. What we know is that STEM is reflective of society. STEM is a part of society. We are not immune to societal inequalities. We're very much reflective of what's going on in the world today. And that includes the inequalities that we're seeing that get put into play through the different power imbalances that we see in careers, in structures, and even the way that prestige is held within the sector as well. I think it's really important to note that the actual inquiry itself, sort of how that played out. So for those who haven't kind of had all the backstory for it, it's really important to note that in 2018, there was a My Science inquiry opening that was done through that committee, one of the previous iterations, where the public could put their requests for inquiries. And it was Professor Rachel Oliver, with support of a group called Tigers in STEM Now, who actually first submitted an inquiry suggestion on the impact of science funding policy on equality, diversity and inclusion and accessibility. So the reason we're here at this point with the inquiry is because of a grassroots push. And that's something to really recognize as well, is that a lot of the work done in this area is still coming from grassroots pushes, still coming from community activism, community justice, community collaboration. And actually what we've finally seen is that through into sort of a professionalized and sort of corporate and governmental sort of response here, but through that process, we've seen it watered down as well. And that's something to really recognize with any activity that we agree to do, whether that be today or tomorrow, is that we have to push further than what will be accepted, because it will get toned down. And that's something to really think about. The APPG on Diversity in STEM, which was established with the British Science Association as secretariat, closely followed after that My Science inquiry. And in 2019, the sort of Science Technology Committee changed. There was a change in government, changing committees. And actually that inquiry then got shelved from that point as well. So in 2020, the APPG inquiry, the APPG on Diversity in STEM set up the inquiry into equity in the STEM workforce, which actually creates a really fundamental and brilliant data piece that a lot of this was then foundational from. The Science Technology Committee launched their inquiry into diversity and inclusion in STEM finally in 2021. And now we are here in 2023 with a report based on lots of pieces of evidence and a government response as well. And actually, the committee themselves have said that the response from government is weak as well. It's a plan for a plan, I think was the quote. And I think we can all look at that and go, actually, yes, there was a, you know, I think we got down to paragraph 99 before we talked about anything other than education, of which most of it was deferred to the Department for Education. So I think it's important to look back a little bit and focus on what were the submissions of evidence from the public, from communities, from organisations into the original inquiry, and even some of the recommendations from that inquiry as well. Because actually, from that point onwards, it's kind of weakened and diluted a little bit. So as a collective, as a community, we can look at those earlier pieces and go, that's where the real teeth is. And that's where we can really look at what we want to do as a collective as well. I think it's really important to note that that kind of balance of power that we have in society with the systems, the structures, access to and distribution of knowledge, resources, history, culture, people don't click that that is fundamental to STEM, because they still have this idea that STEM is objective, and that includes the way that careers are structured in STEM being objective. I think hopefully people are on board with the idea that that's not true, and we're all a product of who we are, who we've been for our lives, the people we interact with, anything from role models to your family to the people within your jobs and your work to your own identity as well. It influences the way that you prioritize things, it influences the way that you interpret things, and it influences the way that you actually perform research or do any innovation or what it is that you're trying to achieve. So with that, I think it speaks to the earlier point that diversity and inclusion within the STEM research and innovation space is so fundamental to that harnessing that creativity, because STEM is a creative pursuit. Innovation is a creative pursuit. So the idea that we would at any point force out groups based on their identity, based on their experiences, or even prejudice against groups from being able to express those parts of their creativity within the STEM workforce really does our entire country and the whole system a disservice. So I think it's really crucial that that business case, although it does feel like it's there, it does feel like it's spoken about, we just have to keep making sure that we re-mention it as well, because every time you walk into a room, there is someone who's going to be saying, well, why is that a problem? Unfortunately, in this inquiry, one of those people was the Minister for Equalities. So that shows kind of the state of the play. And with that, I did want to kind of touch on a few disappointing parts of the inquiry itself as well that I think is really important that we acknowledge happen. There are some difficult instances that really do need to be spoken about in a public forum, because it really shows that, yes, people here are likely, you are likely here because you're interested in this subject, so you're either bought into the idea that diversity and inclusion needs to improve, that there is a problem, that there is potential for solutions. But we had an MP suggesting that young women chose physics at a particular university because of a sexy professor in the inquiry. We had an MP suggesting that disabled students should be prevented from getting access to proper adjustments because of other people gaming the system, despite us all knowing how difficult the system is to work with as a disabled student in the first place. We had a few people gave evidence suggesting that girls don't do physics because they don't want to do hard maths, and that might be a natural thing. And we also had a witness giving oral evidence who was pressured to name and shame employers and leaders who were bullies or harassers or causing problems to the culture of the system that we work in, without the committee ever considering what the impact of doing that in that forum would be, without that committee knowing that NDAs are actually pervasive in our sector for silencing whistleblowers. And I think it's that kind of safeguarding that needs to be there as well. And then, like I said, the MP for Equality is also suggesting that aiming for representation isn't actually important. And also a massive disrespect for non-STEM subjects as well, by really comparing this idea of kind of difficulty and usefulness and actually really disregarding the fact that STEM is fine, great, I love it, I was a geneticist myself, but without the ability to interact with cultural and historical reference points, STEM is somewhat useless because we end up repeating mistakes of the past in our methods, in our impact and things like that. So that's some of the stuff that I think is really important that we just air in this moment as well, because I think it's not been an inquiry that's been smooth sailing, and it's not been an inquiry that's been completely positive. And some of the kind of evidence pieces that did get heard would have affected some people in various ways as well. Another thing that I wanted to sort of note as well is really that one of the things we put forward from EDIS's perspective, and I know this was difficult language to try and explain to a cross-party committee, was about this concept of this being a social justice issue. So this is really about putting a determination for fairness in the heart of what we're doing here, that this isn't just going to be a productivity business case that drives this. This has to be a fundamental fairness point. And that isn't just equality of opportunity, that's equality of outcomes, because the system has been so heavily weighted against some people for so long. And if we are seeing that there is significant underrepresentation and barriers that exist for people, that's leading to, you know, really missing out whole swathes of society in the STEM research and innovation endeavor, we know that the way that you counter that is not to just equal the playing field. You have to rebalance it for a while, at least for a while, before you can get to equality. I think the metaphor of rowing down a river, and, you know, if you stop rowing, the river's still going to row, the river's still going to flow, you're still going to go down that direction. So you have to actively row against it. And I think that's something that we need to really recognize. The other thing I also wanted to talk about was that, like I said, the response that we've got from government has focused a lot on education and early years education, secondary education, and those are really important factors for that start of the career journey. However, they really didn't comment or note on the fact that the science capital that you're building within that space as a secondary school student, maybe into university, that's not something, a concept that needs to be lost throughout your whole of your career. Building science capital throughout your entire career, whether that's in research, in innovation, in academia, in industry, wherever you go, science capital as a concept is really important, because it's not just what you know, it's going to be a lot of who you know, it's going to be a lot of where the opportunities are, it's going to be a lot of how do you explain and describe the work you're doing in a way that's engaging, how do you engage with people who want to fund it? How do you engage with people who want to employ you? How do you engage with even investors if you want to spin an idea out into something? You know, these are all really important parts. And those, that concept of science capital isn't just given to you as a given. You know, you are waiting to hear if you've got someone to support you in that, someone to describe it. There's a clear reason why a lot of Nobel Prize winners have Nobel Prize winner parents and PhDs have PhD parents. You know, it's because someone's told you how that system works and told you the value and the benefit of it. And that often can have a huge impact on the choices you make. The other thing to just note around the government response again, so a 2030 target of a more diverse range of people to enter the science and technology workforce, it's an interesting choice of words. Entering the science and technology workforce does not mean staying in the science and technology workforce. It does not mean thriving there. It does not mean enjoying your work. It does not mean being the best version of yourself and producing the best version of the work that you want to produce. And a more diverse range of people could be as simple as moving that 16% women in engineering to 18%. So I think that's something that we all need to think about, which is actually setting quotas, setting targets, setting things like that. They have negative consequences sometimes, but no data, no numbers is not a choice. It's not something that you can't just aim for more diversity, because who knows what that really means. And I'm also really interested to know which government official is really into maths mastery pedagogy, because that really featured quite heavily in their response as well. And if anyone wants to explain that to me, I'm not aware of that subject. I'm not aware of that method myself. So I'd be interested after drinks for that. The other thing just to note as well, in terms of the culture that we're working in, we know that people experience the culture within the science, technology, innovation, research workforce differently. We know that there's a lot of mixed opinions about whether competitiveness is a positive or a negative there. But we also know that from the Wellcome Trust research culture survey, that 43% of researchers had experienced bullying or harassment. And I think something close to 60 or 70% had witnessed it as well. So the Forum Against Bullying and Harassment is progressing, but those numbers are still shocking. And I think that's something to also recognize, that there are some targeted interventions, targeted actions that do correlate across the whole of the sector that we can focus on. I just wanted to just note that the kind of the six recommendations that EDIS put forward, which on the face of it, when I say them right now, they're going to be seeming quite high level. But what we did do in our response was also list really specific interventions that sit under each of those. So the first one was around investing in inclusive STEM education, with a focus on building science capital across all stages. And we meant that in terms of across all career stages, beyond PhD into whatever part of your career happens after that. We also know that you need to take proactive steps to remove bias and ensure equal outcomes, which is a fantastic way of telling them equitable action and positive action without saying those words, because we knew it might put some of them off. We want to support organizations to create change and embed good practice. We know there's lots of practice happening. How do we ensure that it's happening well within organizations when we know that something's going well? We know that legal frameworks need to be updated, and we need to ensure dissemination and uptake of guidance. Again, thinking about positive action there, there's a lot of availability and service provisions for positive action that are worth looking at if you're a charity, for example, that aren't really spoken about in our space as much. We want to invest in positive culture and incentives that reflect diverse contributions. And when we say invest, we mean money. So we want to see numbers there. And we want to improve consistency in the design, implementation and monitoring of EDI interventions. And we're happy to kind of take on some of that space as well. So with that, I just wanted to finally say thank you to everyone from the EDIS community, from the membership who contributed to that piece of work. It was a real sort of gaining everyone's insights there. My co-authors, Anna and Rachel, who are actually in the room as well, who helped write it. And Anna presented the oral evidence in person for us as well. And I think I'll stop there because I have no idea what time I'm on.